Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The question of the day is, who is in charge of the Internet? The U.S. Appeals Court said this morning it is not the Federal Communications Commission. Net neutrality leads the way for us today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, providing remote access to a Mac or a PC from anywhere. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday today, the 6th of April, and I am glad to have you with us. The case at issue in the Washington, D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals today was Comcast versus Federal Communications Commission, here and after known as FCC. 2 years ago, the FCC said Comcast, which is a big Internet service provider, was not allowed to block some of its customers who'd been using BitTorrent. That's a file swapping service usually used to download really big files, like movies, files that take up a whole lot of Comcast bandwidth. Comcast said, okay, we'll stop, and then it sued. In its ruling today, the court came down with Comcast and against the FCC's stated policy of Internet neutrality. Cecilia Kang covers technology for The Washington Post. Cecilia, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
We probably ought to back up just a sec and remind people what we're talking about here, this thing called net neutrality. Help us out.
Yeah, it's sort of a horrible word, but it's come to mean a lot in Washington. Net neutrality is sort of a concept. It's this idea that all traffic on the Internet should be treated equally. And how that's distilled into real-world terms as a consumer, it means that if you're a subscriber of Verizon or Comcast, the quality of the delivery of, say, the website Hulu, videos on Hulu, should be treated the exact same as, say, video on demand by Comcast. Other applications like Skype should be allowed on your cell phone without a carrier saying yes or no as to whether that should happen. All bits should be treated equally is sort of the idea behind it.
And then the ruling today, what did the court say?
The court said that the FCC actually didn't have the authority, didn't have the power to rule against Comcast in 2008 for blocking BitTorrent, an application over the web. And that ruling may be narrowly focused between Comcast and the FCC, but it really opened sort of a Pandora's box of lots of other questions as to whether the FCC has the ability to regulate Internet services at all.
In terms of how this might play out for consumers now, though, could we conceivably, if we wanted to go to Hulu and watch a bunch of videos, could Comcast now say to us, you have to pay more if you want to watch that because it takes more data, more bits?
So technically, they could. That's what a lot of consumer groups and some analysts are saying, is that a service provider could decide to block or slow down an application. In reality, that would be awfully difficult, mostly because consumers would be outraged if they found out that, say, their Hulu service was disrupted or YouTube was shut down because those videos compete with Comcast video services. So it would be very difficult for an ISP to do that. And the ISPs would argue that it's not in their business interest to do so.
Just to put this into context a little bit, let's think back a couple of weeks. The FCC came out with this huge national broadband plan. I mean, the FCC has Internet plans.
So it's this crazy juxtaposition right now where the FCC is 100% geared towards bringing the agency, bringing the country into this Internet era and really looking at rules and frameworks that would help bring broadband access to 100 million homes, for example, in a decade. And this is all happening while this court decision is putting any sort of plans that the FCC might have going forward into real flux.
Might the Internet service providers just say, listen, let's let the market sort this out. We're not going to do anything bad for consumers, but hey, let's see what market forces bring to bear here in the wild, wild west of the Internet.
To a large extent, that is what they're saying. In fact, Verizon and AT&T have said as recently as 2 weeks ago that maybe the FCC really shouldn't be regulating internet service providers, and that maybe the government should have much more of an arm's length on these issues because the internet is so fast moving and regulations could be so cumbersome. And the internet economy creates jobs and in a time where we really need jobs producing companies to do well. So they've been arguing that quite a bit. But the consumer protection groups would say, if you don't have sort of a cop on the beat, you could have service providers really running amok and making decisions such as blocking or degrading other applications that compete against theirs for their business advantage.
Cecilia Kahn, she's a technology writer for The Washington Post. Cecilia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In Montcoal, West Virginia today, crews are rushing to get emergency drilling equipment in place. Yesterday's explosion at the Upper Big Branch coal mine has left 25 miners confirmed dead. 4 others remain missing. Upper Big Branch is owned by Massey Energy. It's the biggest coal producer in Appalachia. It also, according to federal records, has a worse-than-average safety record. Mining does sometimes seem like a 19th century industry, especially on days like today. But Brett Neely reports that coal's future remains bright.
The accident sent shares of Massey Energy down by as much as 10% today. But overall, shares in coal companies were up. That's because the coal industry, for better or worse, isn't going away. William Watson is in charge of energy analysis at the Energy Information Administration.
Coal consumption is growing at somewhere around 1 to 1.5% a year.
He says 40 years ago, Americans used about 600 million tons of coal a year. Now it's over 1 billion tons. One reason the U.S. burns so much of the stuff is
we have a lot of it.
At least another 100 years' worth of domestic supply, Watson says. Most of the coal in the U.S. is used to produce electricity. It often comes from coal seams near the surface out west, or from dynamiting Appalachian mountaintops. The Upper Big Branch mine was different. It produced met coal, which is used to make steel.
It tends to be very, very high-quality coal. It's in very short supply.
Jim Thompson is the managing editor of Coal and Energy, an industry publication. He says high demand from Asia and the rest of the world makes met coal a lucrative export business for American firms. Met coal is almost always found deeper underground, where the mining is more dangerous. But other coal miners in Appalachia may also have to start digging deeper, too. That's because new federal environmental rules may soon make it next to impossible for mining companies to keep blowing up mountaintops. Here's Jim Thompson again.
It is a trade-off. If you are going to limit surface mining, then you are going to be mining in more dangerous conditions.
As more and more coal mining shifts underground, Thompson said more accidents are bound to happen. When it comes to Massey Energy, analysts at Jefferies & Company said the met coal producer remains undervalued and recommended investors buy its shares. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
British voters will soon get to render their verdict on Prime Minister Gordon Brown and his handling of the UK economy. This morning, Brown set the date for Britain's next general election. It's going to be May the 6th. Financial markets are banking on a Brown defeat, but that's why you have elections, after all, to find the winner. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London.
With the UK out of recession, Gordon Brown today launched his bid to get re-elected.
I'm asking for a clear and straightforward mandate to continue the urgent and hard work of securing the recovery.
But David Cameron, leader of the opposition Conservatives, says Brown saddled Britain with a huge budget deficit. Cameron is pledging to start cutting it immediately if he wins power next month.
Let us get off this road to ruin and instead get on the path to prosperity and progress.
Most investors prefer Cameron's proposed deficit cutting to Brown's promise of recovery. David Buick of BGC Brokers.
It's generally felt that the Conservatives will deal with the budget deficit, which is horrendous, more aggressively than Labour will.
Voters seem less concerned about the deficit. The Conservatives have only a small lead over Labour in the opinion polls. Next month's election could be inconclusive. The parties might have to form a coalition, and that could delay any deficit cutting. James Knightley is UK economist with the ING Bank.
The market fears that that's delay is going to increase the uncertainty and increase the risk that we're not going to get a competent plan in place quickly enough.
He says an indecisive election could lead to Britain losing its AAA credit rating. The election campaign launched today looks to be one of the closest in memory and for the markets, one of the most nerve-wracking. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Back home on Wall Street, traders tried. Today they really did, but I guess Dow 11,000 just wasn't in the cards. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Raise your hand if you've about had it with all those add-on airline fees, and then brace yourself for another one. The Florida-based low-cost carrier Spirit Airlines is going to start charging for carry-on bags come August. If it fits under the seat in front of you, you're fine, no charge. But if you have to put it up in the overhead bin, it's going to cost you up to $45. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has more.
Spirit was the first U.S. airline to charge for checked bags. Now, almost all of them do. Seth Kaplan of Airline Weekly says that doesn't necessarily mean all airlines will follow Spirit's lead when it comes to carry-ons.
Other airlines tend to market themselves as a combination of service-oriented and also value-oriented. Spirit really markets themselves as cheap.
Which is why you can buy a Spirit ticket for as little as $31, even though you may be nickel and dimed right up to the cost of a rival's fare when you add in all the extra fees. But Kaplan says, Spirit beware, not every cost-saving measure goes over well with the passengers.
United planned to charge for meals on transatlantic flights out of Dulles, but they had to pull back after backlash from consumers.
But some industry watchers think there are legitimate reasons for a carry-on fee. Webster O'Brien is an airline consultant with SH&E.
I think those overhead bins are just getting fuller, and so there's a need to figure out how do we manage a limited resource.
Or how do we flyers look for loopholes? Perhaps it's time to buy a big coat or an Abe Lincoln-style hat to store iPods and mini toiletries on flights. Even Spirit isn't charging for wearing luggage yet. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
After a couple of weeks off for their Easter recess, the House and Senate reconvene this coming Monday. And that's about when we're going to start hearing more about financial reform. Senate's still trying to work out exactly what its bill is going to say. Banks and other finance companies have poured millions of dollars into lobbying against reform. Commentator and consumer advocate Kathleen Day says it's time to ignore those guys.
After the mortgage meltdown and the trillions in taxpayer bailouts, it's time to close all the loopholes and stop letting some lenders duck oversight. For too long, we've let some lenders evade the rules everyone else has to follow. That's just led to a race to the bottom in standards for all lenders. Take the bad subprime mortgages that spark the current recession. Banks didn't make the first ones. Finance companies did. Then banks jumped into that market as regulators looked the other way. Eventually, bad products crowded out the good. Why? The bad products seemed to be making money. That is, until everyone realized they weren't and taxpayers had to step in. A loan is a loan is a loan. All lenders should have to follow the same rules, whether they are a payday lender or an auto dealer or a bank. Take payday loans. Plenty of families on the financial brink take out these loans as a quick fix to a financial emergency, only to end up having to take out one loan after another, getting trapped in a cycle of debt. A typical payday borrower pays $400 in interest alone on a $300 loan. True to form, banks are now jumping into payday loans. Just today, bank regulators defended this predatory practice as sound, just like when they said reckless subprime mortgages weren't predatory, and we all know how that's worked out. Congress banned payday loans to military personnel 4 years ago. The Pentagon calls them a national security risk. Now the Pentagon is pushing for this new consumer agency to protect the troops from other harmful loan products. An independent agency could make payday lenders, car lenders, and anybody else who makes loans play by the same rules and protect all of us, not just the military. That's only fair for the financial well-being of millions of families whose lives include more than just a mortgage. We've had the bailouts. Now we need the watchdog.
Kathleen Day is a spokeswoman for the nonprofit Center for Responsible Lending. As always, please send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, how to become a big-time Hollywood producer.
It's not about chutzpah. It was, I just didn't know what the hell I was doing.
But, well, there's lots of kids like that.
I don't take no for an answer. I never have taken no for an answer in my career in anything I've done.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials managed to shed 3 points today, less than a fraction, settled at 10,969. The NASDAQ added 7 points, about a 3rd percent, ended at 2,436. The S&P 500 tacked on 2 points, almost 0.2 percent, finished the day at 1,189. As we mentioned earlier, Comcast beat the FCC in court today over its authority to regulate internet services, but some investors unplugged their modems all the same. Comcast shares powered down nearly a 1/3 of 1 percent. Reports out today have cell phone maker Nokia set to come out with a rival to the iPad later this year. Nokia or Nokia? I can never keep it straight. The news did little to reboot Nokia's stock price. Sure, I guess that settles it. Nokia shares fell by more than 0.5 percent today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.96%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By PBS, this week presenting the story of one man's journey to awakening, The Buddha, premiering Wednesday night at 8, 7 Central, only on PBS. And by MassMutual, offering business owners financial guidance for the long term. Information at MassMutual.com. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its monthly consumer credit report. President Obama is scheduled to depart for Prague, where it is anticipated that he'll sign a treaty with Russia to reduce nuclear arsenals. And the World Health Organization marks World Health Day. This year's theme, 1,000 Cities, 1,000 Lives, aims to promote healthy city living. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. In Santiago, Chile today, the economic effects of February's earthquake became official. The central bank down there lowered its estimate for gross domestic product in the coming year, raised its inflation predictions, too. Businesses all up and down Chile were affected by the 8.8 earthquake, including its lumber-producing areas along the Pacific coast. And now the American wood industry is having some economic aftershocks. Annie Murphy reports.
Tsunamis that followed February's earthquake did as much damage as the quake itself. Residents here in the coastal town of Arauco describe a wave over 30 feet high, and you can see evidence everywhere. I'm at a sawmill that was destroyed. Lumber and heavy machinery are strewn over a couple acres. It looks like a tornado touched down. Rodrigo Guajardo, though, is the manager of this sawmill, or what's left of it. It's called ProSilva Limited. He's out surveying the damage.
Imagine that a wave moved that truck about 500 yards. And here to my left is what it used to be the dining hall for the workers. It's 600 yards from where it used to stand. When I first saw this, the truth is I almost cried because I have been working here for the past 15 years.
The area around Arauco is home to Chile's booming wood industry. After copper, wood is the country's second biggest export.
It affects the United States. It affects the world.
Lloyd Erland is a professor at the Yale School of Forestry. He says Chile is a great case study in globalization.
You know, here's this small country with a very small forest resource, which is a prominent supplier to China of pulp and paper. It's a prominent supplier of solid wood products to the United States market. It has woven itself into supply chains that reach into Europe. And so when something happens there that disrupts their supply, all of a sudden people pay attention at lumber yards, construction sites, and paper mills in a lot of different places in the world.
One of those people is Mark Shervin. He's the president of Consolidated Companies, based in New Jersey. His company imports Chilean lumber, door parts, and molding. He says prices rose 30% after the quake.
There's been a sharp increase in pricing, and I think a lot of that is due to the quandary as to when things will start flowing again.
But Shervin feels like he's in a good position because his company also sells American wood products. He says the Chile earthquake could mean opportunity in the U.S. for domestic wood.
Purchasers of wood products, they'll realize that maybe all the eggs should not have been placed in the import basket, and maybe they should continue to support domestic production.
Even those directly hit by the earthquake are looking to make the best of the destruction, like sawmill manager Rodrigo Gujardo.
Before the earthquake, the wood industry was on standby because of the economy crisis in the United States. Now we're seeing prices jump as high as 42% in the U.S. because of demand. So I think this could actually turn out very well in the long run. In every catastrophe, there is opportunity.
But standing before the crushed sawmill, it's hard to imagine this business up and running anytime soon. Meanwhile, aftershocks continue to rumble below our feet. Experts say it may take up to a year for these tremors to subside, and it may take even longer for Chile's lumber industry to recover from the quake. In Arauco, Chile, I'm Annie Murphy for Marketplace.
If you follow entertainment in this country at all, you've probably heard the name Jerry Weintraub, even if you can't remember exactly when or how. He's a producer and a manager. He's a sometime actor, also a philanthropist, what you might call old-school Hollywood. He took Elvis and Sinatra on the road back in the 1960s. Then came the movies, Nashville, Diner, The Karate Kid, and most recently Ocean's 11, 12, and 13 with Brad Pitt and George Clooney.
Why do this? Why not do it? Because yesterday I walked out of the joint after losing 4 years of my life and your cold decking Teen Beat cover boys. Because the house always wins. Play long enough, you never change the stakes, the house takes you. Unless, when that perfect hand comes along, you bet big and then you take the house.
Jerry Weintraub's been betting big his whole career. It's a story he tells in his new biography, When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. We went out to his house in Beverly Hills last week and I asked him how he got into the business to begin with.
I think I naturally found my way into it because my mother went to movies all the time. She loved film. My mother tried never to leave New York, and she traveled the world through the movies.
You started, though, in music with arranging shows and production.
Yeah. I've had a long, interesting career. But I was in music, yes. I was in business with Elvis Presley, Frank Sinatra, Led Zeppelin, the Moody Blues, the Carpenters, Neil Diamond, John Denver, in production business, in the music mm-hmm. business, in the music publishing business. And I controlled most of the arenas in the country in the late 60s and early 70s.
You actually revolutionized that concert business a little bit because you took the middleman out of the arrangement, right? Those local guys who controlled those
Correct.
Markets.
Correct, I did. They weren't very happy about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I bet.
In those days, there were local promoters in each city that controlled different areas of the country. But when I got Elvis, he was such an important attraction, and I was able to go directly to the arenas and make deals.
It's an amazing thing to be able to say, when I got Elvis. Tell us a story of how you wound up in business with Elvis Presley.
I sleep, still do, with a pen and pencil next to my bed. And I had a dream one night, and I wrote down, Jerry Weintraub presents Elvis Presley at Madison Square Garden. I wrote it down on a piece of paper. Showed it to my wife, and she said, why don't you go back to sleep? She said, you know Elvis Presley? I said, no, I don't know Elvis Presley. She said, well, how are you going to do this? I said, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it because I wrote it down. Next morning, I called his manager, a man named Colonel Tom Parker.
Sure.
And he got on the phone, talked to me, and I said, I want to take Elvis Presley on concert tour. And he said to me, not a chance, not going to happen. And for the next year, one solid year, I called him every morning when I got up. And one day he said to me, you still want my boy for concerts? And I said, yes. He said, okay, you come to Las Vegas tomorrow, bring me a check for $1 million or cash, either one.
All right.
$1 million. Now, in those days, I thought only one person had $1 million, Rockefeller. You know, I didn't know anybody that had $1 million. $1 million was way out of my league.
How old were you?
I was a kid, 20-something years old. But I got the $1 million to the colonel. We sat down 3 weeks later, and I ended up in San Diego, and I was a multimillionaire.
Could that happen today, do you think?
No.
It's kind of too bad, isn't it?
Too bad?
Yeah, don't you think?
Well, it can't happen. It's not going to happen again.
But some young kid out there who's got the same kind of chutzpah that you do, I mean...
Well, it's not about chutzpah. I just didn't know what the hell I was doing.
But, well, there's lots of kids like that.
And I don't take no for an answer. I never have taken no for an answer in my career in anything I've done.
This is going to sound maybe a little bit pejorative, but it's not meant that way.
Pejorative? How do you know I know what that word means?
I'm figuring you've been around a while. You know. There is a great sense you get from reading your book that a huge part of how you got things done was just kind of winging it and seeing what happened.
No. I can see where you think that I was winging it, but I had a purpose with everything that I did. I didn't do anything that I didn't think was going to count or was it going to be an event, including this book. The book has to be an event for me or I won't be happy.
Does it ever get tiring, though, always having to make something out of something?
No, it's what I do. I love it. It gets me up in the morning. No, not even a little bit.
Jerry Weintraub tells the story of his life in a book called When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead. Mr. Weintraub, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We've got the first chapter of that book up on our website. It's marketplace.org. And you can check out some pictures of Jerry with the king, too. That'd be Elvis, of course.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, providing remote access to a Mac or a PC from anywhere. More at gotomypc.com/market. By American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. And by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, you might have heard about California's budget troubles and how some state offices here have been closing one day a month to save money. Well, the folks up in Sacramento have nothing on Los Angeles. This afternoon, Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa announced that all city departments except police, public safety, and those that make money are going to have to shut down 2 days a week. The city controller said yesterday L.A. is going to run out of money by the end of this month. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 3 points. That's less than a fraction of 1%. The Nasdaq rose 7 points, a third of 1%. The S&P 500 gained 2 points. That's about 0.2% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that's where you ought to tune in tomorrow morning for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, demand soars for this shiny ore.
It's the finest metal that everybody's requesting. Even though it's costing more money, they still want platinum.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.